Welcome to the DL.
It's Tuesday morning. The only thing CBS did wrong was start that goddamn game at 9:30. I'm so tired.
I know. And honestly, I guess it was a fairly brisk game, all things considered. Which made it even worse. It's like, well, this could have been over. You know, if we start this at 8:30, we'd done an hour ago. It didn't really drag. It just, as far as the time goes, just dragged in every other way.
Look, I don't mean to complain, and I mean I stayed up and I watched the game. I don't mean to complain about it starting at 9:30 or 9:30 and change. But the question I have is why? Because I mean, I understand the logic that you want the game to be in prime time for as long as possible. And if you start a game at 8:30 on the East Coast, it's Houston is 2 hours different, so it's 6:30 local, and then it makes it 5:30 on the West, or 7:30 local and 5:30 on the West. I get that, but when you finish a game at 11:30 on the East, that you're not even getting credit for the ratings. So the last 8 minutes of the game, barely even registers on the East Coast. It seems weird to me that they wouldn't have started this game at 9:00 and they would have waited till 9:30.
I would love if we had a show, we could have someone on to talk about these type of things in the future. I just would love to get the rationale for not catering per se, but yes, in a way, catering to the West Coast, because it always seems to me the West Coast ratings don't tend to be as good as East Coast ratings. You're talking about a Midwest and an East Coast team in this particular game. Now, you can make the argument that if you're a Connecticut fan, they start the game at midnight, you're going to stay up for it, you don't care. But it's odd to me because I don't know how many people are running out of work on the West Coast. It's a different animal on the West Coast. It's a whole different ball game. They're not as into sports quite as much as sort of the East Coast vibe. And a lot of it's because, it's warm. There's things to do. Now, I'm just going by California. There's lots of places on the West Coast. But
yeah, the people in Denver are looking at you saying, wait a minute.
Yeah.
But it's not West. But,
yeah, well, that's not yet. That's Central. Oh, no, it's Mountain Time. But the bottom line is, it strikes me. And I know you can't start a game at 4:30 out there. It kind of stinks. But at the same time, I've talked to enough people out there who say, man, it is great to get out of work at 5:30 and go watch a game right away. And then you can watch the whole game and then go do something else. So even if you do start it at 8:30 and do it at 5:30 out there, I think that works. But they do what they do, and we're up all night trying to watch this game.
John Tannenwald from Philly.com. He writes the soccer blog and the college basketball blog. So he had some thoughts, and he's up overnight. So he and I had already talked. We're going to put that on after this, and you'll notice my voice gets quieter, yet maybe louder, because I think I'm closer to the microphone, because it was 5:15 in the morning, 5:30 in the morning. I didn't want to wake up anybody else in the house. So we're going to get to that. And we talk a little bit about Charles Barkley and a little bit about the way that the game was handled. But I want to ask you first, because obviously we try and focus more on media stuff. I said that the only thing CBS did wrong, now we ripped Charles Barkley a few weeks ago. Overall, from a pullback and look at the championship game, maybe even the Final Four, did everything work for CBS? I mean, they had a terrible game. It seemed like the people on Twitter were angrier than the people covering the game, and you expected Charles Barkley especially to go nuts about the quality of play. I felt that they handled it so well that I almost wished Billy Packer was in that booth somewhere.
Oh, God, don't ever say that. You know, it's funny because I was watching – I guess I flipped by ESPN Classic a couple weeks back, or before the tournament started. They had the Carolina-Michigan game on. That's been getting so much play because of the Fab Five documentary. And I realized just how horrible Billy Packer was again. And trust me, watch a game and you'll take back everything you just said. And I know you say it, yes, but trust me, you were like, oh, this is so grating and horrible. All in all, I thought, and I think you may have tweeted this somewhere or said it, maybe just sent it to me in email. I thought Kerr was a fantastic addition. That three-man booth worked for me. That was a good booth. I liked it. I didn't hear anything on Saturday night because I was at a bar for both games. But last night, I did get to hear them, and I said, wow, this works. I like this. It's a little bit more interplay. It's a little less Nance because, as we've all said, we just don't feel he has the same passion for basketball as the golf. But that part worked. And the halftime at this point, it is what it is. We've gotten used to it. I think they did a fine job. But all in all, as a Final Four, with the hand they were dealt, I thought they did a nice job. The whole tournament, bottom line, start to finish, was, from a media perspective, fantastic because of the new system, because of getting all the games on TV. And if nothing else, it working on the first weekend, to me, washes away anything that happens after that, because that's the part I think I'm most passionate about, I'm most excited about, is watching all those games. And being able to watch all of them and have them covered on four high-definition networks was great for me.
All right, so let's get to sort of the point of what everyone was tweeting yesterday and everyone's writing about today. If you follow all the media people that you follow on Twitter and read their actual columns, you'll know that most of them wrote the story of the game. Everyone always looks for an angle. Everyone always looks for a hook. There are two angles that I've read so far. One is Jim Calhoun, and one is, wow, what a crappy game. And I think that the sports writers are privately, secretly happy that the game was so bad because it gave them an easy thing to write about. I think that everybody wants to watch great basketball. I'm not saying that they were actually happy to watch a bad game. But as curmudgeon-y, if that's a word, as people are who work in this industry, it gave them an easy angle. They didn't have to think of a storyline. They didn't have to manufacture any sort of Kemba Walker storyline because they got a terrible game. And you could just write how bad the game was. And it seems like everybody is doing that. So I'll ask you the question that everyone got mad at me for putting – talk about a meta conversation. Everyone got mad at me for saying on Twitter, which is more annoying, watching bad basketball or reading about it on Twitter? And then people say, or putting out polls, asking people which is worse. So I ask you one of those three questions.
How many questions were there? were they secret – I mean, there is a part of, trust me, you and I have had to sit down and write these things. There's a part of you that, yes, it enjoys having the easy angle. It does make, especially when you're writing. I mean, I know the internet's different these days, but if you're a regular ink-stained wretch trying to write for the paper at that time of the night, it's kind of nice to just get it going. And there was somebody on Twitter, I forget who said it was, or it was retweeted, that they were joking about how within the first 5 minutes of the game, the person next to them was already writing the story with Connecticut winning. And it may have been Ravel who made a Mad Libs joke
about
that. Well,
Mike Wise tweeted just after halftime, I have to file a story almost immediately after the buzzer sounds, talk to everybody later. And so that's sort of an interesting thing, that the deadlines in the actual paper, in the hold it in your hand paper, are still so short because, I mean, the game ends at midnight. You got to get a paper out by 5 a.m. that a guy like Mike Wise, who's a pretty dynamic tweeter, wasn't able to do that during the second half of a game he was covering because he had to actually do his job.
Yeah, no, exactly, and concentrate and get this thing done. Now, luckily for everybody, I think that after Connecticut went on that 14-1 run early in the second, it was over, and that's how I treated it as well, and sort of became antsy and flipping around at that point. But were they happy? I mean, somewhere down deep, but at the same time, I think it's more rewarding to write a story about a good game because you do have to sort of bring your A game. You have to find the angles. You have to sort of dig something out and make it sound good. This is the easy story. It gets the job done. You're done. You're in. You're out. But as far as what you might actually get something out of, yeah, it would have been better to have a good game, I think, for them. And that was the antithesis of a good game.
Well, see, it's funny that you got antsy. I got excited in a weird sort of sadistic way. I got excited when Butler had 28 points for what seemed like an hour because I didn't think that they were ever going to score again. And I wanted to see if Butler could get into the national championship game, any team, not just Butler, because they're a likable team. Any team could get to the national championship game and be so tight in the second half that they scored 6 points or 7 points, whatever. I think it was 6 points. They would have scored, because for the first half of that half, you know, which would have been, I guess, the third quarter if you're Kenny Smith or Charles Barkley, they scored 6 points. It was inexplicable. And I kept making jokes, and I said it to Tannenwald, so you'll hear this twice for people listening. Was it the rims? And people were like, stop it.
I felt the same way.
There had to be something going on. It was so funny.
I was thinking, how am I going to phrase this tomorrow? And then I saw you mentioned on Twitter. I said, all right, well, at least someone else is thinking it. I would never blame the rims. It's not the rims' fault. But there was something weird going. I mean, it was as if the ball and the rim were the same side of a magnet, just propelling off of each other.
Right.
Because it made no sense. And the sound they were making. And again, this is not blaming it. I mean, Butler just played poorly. But it was something odd. It's like I've never heard – even the balls that went in sounded absolutely –
They rattle, and even Nance a couple times. Oriaki rattles one. By the way, for people that don't know, and I mentioned this on Twitter last night, they do mic the backboards and the rims, and they do that for sort of the ambient noise. They do that because people like to hear that clanging sound, except when it happens every time down the court. And then you think – cut that mic or turn it down a little bit. They do have, I mean, there's Parab mics on the baselines to get the just sort of the ambiance and the guys talking. You heard guys talking all night which I always think is dangerous, by the way, because the kids are cursing like crazy. Even the refs sometimes are cursing, and certainly the coaches, although I don't know Brad Stevens well enough. On the other side, you don't need to prep Mike too close to Jim Calhoun. It's fascinating to me, though, how loud CBS had the backboard microphone, because at some point it just became the entire storyline of the game, that these rims, this was not an, they should have just gone at halftime and asked the Houston Rockets if they could borrow their rims, because whatever NCAA rims they brought in were super tight and super duper loud.
And someone had even made, it may have been Pat Forty, he was making a comment after the game, the two games on Saturday, saying that somebody was mentioning that one of the rims, you know, it was odd in some shape, form, or fashion. Was mentioning even that day and I guess with both teams that shot on that rim, it was looking a little bit weird. So, you know, who knows? It's certainly not the reason they lost the game. There's a lot of other reasons they lost the game, but it's a shame you had to look at it during the game and think that, and even talk about it afterwards. And the other part that people did bring up is that the quality of play always seems to go down when they stick these games in these cavernous football
games. And Tannenwald says that too. And people hear that again. It's different for some of the teams. Although some teams have done that before. So I don't know. I mean, have you? I don't know.
Listen, I don't go to enough games, you know, obviously I'm not in, and I haven't watched enough and taken notes on them, but when people who do sort of bring that up, you have to feel there's some merit to it. And again, none of these things are the reason that any of the three teams that lost this weekend lost. There were, you know, it comes down to the play on the court, but it seems to affect it in some way. And it's like, again, I'd rather be talking about what happened, just the play than these weird peripheral things, but the peripheral things seem to have some effect, or at least enough that it was in your head as you were watching the game.
Do you know if anybody has a Clark Kellogg like Tumblr or a Twitter feed? We should have done it.
Some good isms last night.
Clark Kellogg had, the pumpkin instead of an orange, and I put a thing on Twitter saying that I wonder what he calls other balls. You know, sports as gourds would be a great thing for Clark Kellogg. What does he call a football? Somebody's like, butternut squash. I mean, just think of the different gourds that he would call different balls. An acorn squash could be like a tennis ball would be bigger than that. I think a storm just hit my house.
Wow.
If we get cut off, it's because we're not, it's nothing happened to us. We weren't kicked off the air. Just science took our power. But it's interesting to see. I'm trying to think of some other ones that he had. That would be a great
talk about
piece.
Wearing your working hat. I hope you had your working hat on today or something. I was going to ask you today if you brought your working hat. And there was another one that really stuck in my head, and it's gone now. I should write these things down, really.
Next year, yeah, at the beginning of the tournament, somebody needs to do a Clark Kellogg a Twitter feed for some of the isms that he has, because they're just – and he does it on purpose. He does it so we talk about it. I mean, I don't think he really talks like that in real life. That'd be great. You like have just sort of like a business pitch meeting with Clark Kellogg, and he just starts throwing out these crazy references to random vegetables. It would be fantastic.
Going to get the guy pumping his gas. He's going to put the pumpkin in my gas tank. What are you talking about, sir?
So overall thoughts about, we're not going to talk about anything else other than the tournament. We're going to get to Tannenwald in a minute, but for you, overall thoughts from the tournament compared to other, can you compare this to other years? Have we entered a whole new world with March Madness on demand being even more prevalent? You can watch it on your fingers. If you have the right nail polish, I think at this point, not that I wear nail polish, you get the Turner combination. You get every single game, so we can't bitch anymore about CBS producers going or directors going to the wrong game at the wrong time. We got to watch everything. Have we entered an entire new era of NCAA tournament watching this year?
For me, it was on display last night, and I'll let you know, I saw your logistics commercial finally.
Jesus, thanks.
But no, I had to watch something for work that I had to get done last night, and I got home very late, so I knew I was going to miss about the first 10 minutes of the game. I said, oh, wait, I have a fancy phone. Let me just put it on this fancy phone. So I put the March Madness on demand on the coffee table while I was finishing up on TV, and was able to keep an eye on, not just, watch the game on sort of the comments on Twitter. I was able to see it and as well watch the television, what I had to watch until that was over. Yeah, it's great in that way. And, beyond that, I didn't have need to watch a lot of March Madness on a game because I was unfortunately in front of televisions. But that is a wonderful thing for everybody to be able to check that out, as well as the four game. The four networks. That is revolutionary to me. It did open up a new world. The ratings were great. People were saying positive things. So, literally, it's a shame that I don't think the tournament in everyone's minds will come down to this final game, but I think this is an overwhelmingly positive tournament for everybody, that there are very few complaints other than people saying, my bracket sucked, but hey,
everybody's
every year. Yeah, I mean, everyone's did it, and it happens every year. But no, this was great. This was the – I think they sort of – they figured it out now, a little bit of fine-tuning going into next year, and I think people will be acclimated to it and even more excited for it and ready to go. So I have – nothing bad to say about their coverage this year. You know, and again, a little bit of fine tuning and you know, maybe learning some of the folks better who are going to be contributing, and we'll be good to go for 2012.
By the way, how close was I on the Nantism? My God. I mean, do I get partial credit if I show my work? Jim Nant, my Nantism with about 8 minutes to go was UConn is the big dog in college basketball this year, or in college basketball. Jim Nantz's actual line was Connecticut is the top dog in 2011.
After a tough dog fight?
Oh, how about that? I mentioned it. Oh, my God, Jim Nantz.
Look,
and Wyshynski, by the way, Greg Wyshynski is going to be on tomorrow, so we're going to talk about this, and we'll talk about hockey too. But when I mentioned last year about, I thought it was in poor taste, was 2 years ago at this point, but I think it was in poor taste that Al Michaels used the term dogfight. You and I got into a big conversation about this because Al Michaels should know better. Because it was just after the Michael Vick situation. And Wyshynski was one of the many people who said, you're an idiot, a dogfight is a term used for planes fighting in war. Not when Jim Nantz used it last night. Jim Nantz used it as a pun on the Bulldogs playing the Huskies. He pulled that out of his scripted back pocket going to break, like David Caruso taking off a pair of sunglasses. It was awful. It was a terrible moment. And I think a guy who covers the NFL should have more sense than that. I hope, and I haven't read all the pundits, but I hope Deitch, Raceman, crush him for that. And look, I'm not saying that we can't make that reference. We say it, it happens. But to script that when there are two teams who have dogs, that was in poor taste. I think that needs to be addressed more. I'm glad you brought that up.
No, it does, because as you know, I used the term maybe earlier this week, you know, earlier late
last
week.
Yeah.
You know, I'm on the fence about it. I do think it's just part of the lexicon at this point. A lot of it actually refers more, I feel like, planes fighting World War II, you know, in our, when we say it, as far as talking about a sporting event. But when he specifically said it because it was a dog team versus a dog team, I mean, that was in poor taste. I think that was right when I was getting ready to go upstairs and finish watching in my bed. And I was about to turn the TV off, and I heard it, and I just looked over, and I go, oh, boy, I can't wait for Dan to comment on this.
Yeah, I should have. I'm glad you brought that up, because I had – I mean, it's weird, because when you tweet things, you think that everyone's already heard them, and you forget what you discussed. But, yes, that was extremely poor taste, although I think he had two Nantzisms at the end of the game. One, I mean, come on, big dog, top dog. I mean, now you're talking small semantics, but I think I should get partial credit for nailing that one for his – final. But then he throws another one in, and it's not sort of the official Nantzism, because the official one was at the end of One Shining Moment. He threw in Connecticut is best in show. It's like he had a list of 20. I mean, he had to write the same jokes, and I don't think we thought about this before. We were so concerned with Cinderella. Like, I made the joke that if Butler came back to win that game, he would have said, well, Cinderella looks ugly tonight, but at least she's still dancing. You know, something, some Cinderella joke. He didn't. He wrote dog jokes. He wrote dog jokes the entire game and then just threw in the team that was appropriate at the time. That is as lazy as you can get. And I like Jim Nantz. But I like Jim Nantz, but I honestly feel that at this point, college basketball may not be for him. I mean, he's not doing that at the Masters, is he?
I mean, hope so. That'd be great.
And Tiger roars his way to another green jacket. I mean, does he do that? No, he's got more respect for the game than that. Stop with the cheesy puns, especially with the dogfight. I'm so glad you brought that up. Like, I would have been so mad at myself. We would have done 15 minutes on the show tomorrow with Wyshynski had I forgotten about that. And then you mentioned it after we record. I applaud you for bringing it up.
I do what I can.
Yell it on the DLPodcast.com. Tannenwald will be up next. And again, we focus more on – well, I'm not going to tease too much, but we talk a lot about Butler and what they did and what that means for college basketball, and also talk a little bit about what if ESPN had done – the tournament. Who would be calling the Final Four for them? So we get into that and some other stuff too. Again, Wyshynski tomorrow. I'm trying to remember the schedule. Shane Bacon and Jay Busby are going to preview the Masters. My God, this is my favorite week. End of the NCAA tournament and the beginning of the Masters. And baseball started. What a great day to have the last couple episodes of a show. Or what a great week. We will I will talk to everybody this week. Nick, you might be on later in the week, but I'm not sure. We'll figure that out. So for everybody else, Tannenwald's up next. Let's get to that now. We bring in John Tannenwald, and by the magic of splicing things together, I actually did this interview earlier in the morning, so I'm being quieter. So I apologize if I sound creepy. But John, your thoughts on either the best or worst, or at least it was competitive, game of the in the history of the world?
Look, it was really bad basketball. There was a lot of poor shooting. Obviously, Butler didn't play well. Connecticut used its advantage in talent and athleticism in the second half. I don't care. For me, it's not about the quality of the basketball. It's about putting the two teams out there on a floor in the middle of a football stadium where nobody's going to play basketball until the next time the Final Four goes in there, and seeing which team can win a national championship. I would have liked to see Butler win. I think that no matter what, I think that what Connecticut's done over the last month is extraordinary. And I think what Butler's done over the last 2 years, given how relatively little money they have in terms of athletic department budget and television revenue and all that stuff, the fact that they made the national championship game 2 years in a row is a really extraordinary accomplishment and one worth celebrating, even though they didn't win the title.
I think if ESPN does a 40 for 40, you have to do a story on Butler. I mean, you have to.
Absolutely. And it's Brad Stevens.
Right. By the way, you brought up the TV money. Greg Aiello, who's the head PR guy for the NFL, when Butler got to the title game, kept tweeting about Butler. And I said, he's either gone crazy after the lockout or he went to Butler. It turns out he went to Notre Dame. So he's just gone crazy. But one of the things he tweeted was, Butler is the Green Bay Packers of college basketball, where the little guy can win, and where, you know, the competitive balance proves that anyone can get to the finals. And I wrote back, other people wrote back, and the first thing I said was, when Butler gets the same TV deal as the Big East or the ACC, then you can make that comment. Until then, it's asinine. It's
exactly right. Exactly right. I mean, there's no equality between UConn and Butler the way there is between the Packers and the Bears.
Right.
It's not even close.
But I don't want to harp on that too much, but there's no equality between what Butler has done and really anything else in sports. I mean, you could make the case in some of the other NCAA sports, there's Cinderellas that get there. There's Northeast baseball teams that get to the World Series every once in a while. There's small schools that are really good in, say, just lacrosse, who get to the Final Four that don't maybe have as much athletic funding, but they have funding for those sports. Butler is the complete uneven playing field. You might be able to make the case that Boise State in football is that way. But I don't think so, because they're still selling out a huge stadium, and they've got the Nike deal. You know, that was a slow build over the course of 10 years. I don't think we've seen anything like this Butler team.
The closest thing I can think of in another sport is the Tampa Bay Rays in 2008.
That's pretty good, although that's of their own making, though.
Correct. I'm trying to find – here we go, the red line. For those of you who don't know who – Kyle Wellston is. He writes this blog called midmajority.com. I know, Dan, you've had him.
Yeah, last year we did not have him this year. We should have, but he was. He seemed very busy.
You know, he puts together every year a thing called the Red Line, which is a delineation of what he defines as the mid-major conferences and what he doesn't. And it's a formula. An average athletic budget under $20 million and or a men's basketball budget under $2 million. And it's on a conference average basis, not on a per team basis. So there are, you know, obviously Memphis, even though this past season Conference USA was technically a mid-major conference, obviously Memphis is not a mid-major school in terms of the way it spends its money.
Right.
The Big East averages $6.1 million per school in basketball budget. The Horizon League averages $1.8 million in basketball budget. The Big East averages $40.7 million overall in athletic departments, which is the lowest of the six schools in BCS, by the way. That's presumably because a lot of those schools don't have football. The Horizon League is $8.5 million. And, you know, that's not just – add to that, obviously some of the budget comes from television revenue. But the day on which the two teams will really be equal is in two parts. The first, because the second will derive from the first. The first is when as many people watch Horizon League basketball on ESPN as they watch Big East basketball. And the second, in turn, is when the television rights fee payout to the Horizon League is the same as it is to the Big East.
Look, but here's the thing. It shouldn't be. It shouldn't be.
Right, and you and I agree on this. I'm just making the point.
Right, okay, all right. I just want people to understand that neither of us are saying that there should be competitive balance. There should be teams that we pay better, more attention to because it's usually better basketball. What Butler has done, and I always equate the NCAA tournament to the SATs. What Butler has done, and to some extent VCU did this year, is they figured out a way to beat the SATs. They aren't the best team in college basketball, but they have figured out over a two-year span how to win in the tournament. And that's a totally different thing. If Butler were in the Big East, they're a good team. Not last night, but they're a good team. Would they win most of their games? I don't know. I mean, Connecticut won the national championship, did not lose a game outside the Big East, but finished ninth in that conference. Does that say something about they took the regular season off? Or does that say something about how good that conference is? Where does Butler end up? We're never going to know. And the point is, we don't have to know. Because Brad Stevens didn't recruit players to play in the Big East. He recruited players to play in the Horizon and then win some tournament games. And that's what happened. So that's the difference. And that's what people are going to say, oh, Butler would never survive in the Big East. Of course they won't. And that's why I always think it's funny when these mid-major coaches get big-time jobs. They recruit a different mentality of player.
But you know what? And I'm going to take Penn as an example because they used to be a national power. And they've not been since the Ivy League decided to not have athletic scholarships. If you dropped Penn in the Big East, immediately, yes, they'd struggle. 3 years out, being able to recruit with Wharton and the Palestra, they'd be just, and scholarships, they'd be just as good as the other schools. And the only reason why I bring that up is because people say, well, if you drop Butler in the Big East, they wouldn't be any good. And I always ask people to make sure that they clarify, as I'm sure, Dan, is the point you're making. In the immediate term, they wouldn't be that good. But 3 years in, who knows?
Fine. 3 years in, who knows? I mean, I think right now they'd be better than Providence. They'd probably have a better chance to recruit than Seton Hall. I mean, there are teams that this is the, you and I are we're not turning this into a soccer conversation, but this is the old Alexi Lalas thing where there are MLS teams better than some of the English Premier League teams. Of course there are, because some of the English Premier League teams are terrible because there's 20 of them. And not every team is going to be great. So, yeah, in the Big East, not every team is great. But at the very top, I don't know. And the point is it doesn't matter. That's what I was trying to say. It doesn't matter because Butler has shown that you can win your league or get to the finals of your league, do well, get an at-large bid into the tournament, and then beat the test. And the test is winning games two in one weekend, two in the next weekend, and then two in the following weekend. And so far, they, you know, 2 years in a row, they won, what, 5 of 6? That's pretty damn good. And it's something that we've never seen before. And I don't know if we'll see again. You hope that this Butler team gets to the Final Four every year until they win it. It would be really neat to see a team like that be a powerhouse every year.
And I would take it just a step further, which is to say that there are, you know, the good teams and the bad teams. Butler, this wasn't even the best Butler team, nor was it the best UConn team, nor was it the best Virginia Commonwealth team of recent years, nor was it the best Kentucky team. But they were good enough, and they won the games that they were supposed to win. There are a lot more good teams in college basketball than there have ever been. There are not as many great teams as there used to be. It's like, I like to compare it a little bit to Major League Baseball, where people like to talk about how the AL East is usually, quote unquote, the best division in Major League Baseball because the Yankees and Red Sox are so good. Well, the bottom of the American League is awful.
Well, not this
year. National League, the top and the bottom are not so far separated. So sometimes you get a little more entertaining baseball in the National League, but the teams aren't as good as the Yankees and the Red Sox.
Right. And again, going back to your point before, I do not think that Butler getting to the Final Four or VCU getting to the Final Four is going to translate into bigger contracts for their conferences. I think that Butler should get more handpicked games. And for people who don't know this, ESPN takes teams, mostly more in college football, but a lot in college basketball, and this is how you get rivalry week, and this is how you get bracket busters and stuff. They handpick teams and put them against each other and say, look, we're going to put you on at 11 a.m. on a Wednesday, but you're going to be on national TV, and the teams always say yes because they want as many national TV games as possible. I think Butler has gotten themselves out of the, we'll put you on at noon on a Wednesday, and into the, we'll give you three games on a weekend in prime time,
And let's hope the College Game Day goes to Hinkle Fieldhouse next year.
Well, I think they have to. I mean, I think that they have to do more to embrace that team and to especially if both coaches who got to the took their teams to the Final Four stay at their schools, which it looks like Shaka Smart is staying at VCU. If both coaches stay, I think ESPN and even CBS, if they can get, you know, an out of conference.
CBS did this year, to their credit. They did Stanford at Butler this year.
And they patted themselves on the back and talked about it every single second they could. But if they can do that.
Fine, but they did it.
I know. And they did it and they got the payoff for it because that team went back to the Final Four. If they can do that again, if they can raise the profile of that team, of those teams, it turns into a Memphis in Conference USA. There's a have and all these other have-nots, which will help Butler. I don't know if it necessarily translates to the rest of the conference, and it shouldn't. It shouldn't have to.
I think it's more likely that it will turn into a Gonzaga.
Right, perfect
West Coast Conference.
Right.
Than the Conference USA, because Memphis plays in an NBA arena. And they have some inherent recruiting advantages with that. But I would love it if the Horizon League became a Midwestern version of the West Coast Conference, where now there's two or three teams every year that are on the doorstep of getting at-large bids.
All right, so my last question for you. Let's ask you what you thought overall of the way that the game was handled by the people who covered the game on TV. I don't want to get into the whole Twitter thing because it just annoyed me and I annoyed myself and I was sort of, everyone kept getting mad at me because I said it was the rims. Of course it's not the rim. I mean, it might have been, but of course,
basketball on a football stadium. I don't
unnatural.
Want to say it's not proper because I think that's too strong a statement.
It's unnatural.
Right, exactly.
It's hard for the kids to shoot, and we've both been there and seen how vast it is, and you think that it wouldn't matter because you're looking at the rim, but you're not, because the depth perception of what's behind you is totally different. That being said, Syracuse plays in a football stadium all the time. So Big East teams are used to that at least once a year. Syracuse is used to that all the time. I'm trying to think if there's any other team that plays all of their home games in a football stadium other than Syracuse. But a lot of these teams, and neither of the teams in the championship game, but I think Kentucky, they play their conference tournament games in football stadiums. So some of these bigger schools should be used to that. That shouldn't necessarily still be an excuse for some teams. And they just played 2 days ago, and they had at least three shoot-arounds. So for that to be the excuse in the championship game, and Charles Barkley was the one who said it. So, I mean, I appreciate the fact that people are looking for reasons why the shooting was so poor. But it should have been better than the first couple games, and it wasn't. It was significantly worse.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's exacerbated when they run the court lengthwise instead of halfwise. Not by much, but it makes the behind the baskets even deeper because there's all that floor seating. But you brought up Barkley, and we started the tournament by talking about him, and perhaps it's fair that we end the tournament by talking about him. Because he was obviously he was going to be very forthright. He's Charles Barkley. But I really appreciated what he had to say about the nature of the accomplishment of Butler and UConn and how much he enjoyed himself at the Final Four. Because I thought that was even more honest than he usually is.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. I mean, it was interesting, though, at the very end of the game, he said, this is my first Final Four. It just reminds you, like, what are you doing? Well, you know, I mean, he's Charles Barkley, yes, but he was never even there as a player. You know, I mean, there's got to be somebody else in the system who played there. No, I mean, and again, it goes back to Jay Billis. I mean, he works for the other network, but he didn't used to. They used to share him. And it sort of reminded you, like, as good as Charles Barkley is on NBA stuff, he's an NBA analyst, he's an NBA player. He was a good college player, but he never was on a good team, or a great team, you know, never on a Final Four team. And it just sort of reminded you, like, right at the Final Four, you had to mention that you had never been there before. Just keep that to yourself, damn it.
But even Greg Gumbel, and I think this is to Greg's credit, from the start, he asked the right questions of Kenny Smith and Charles Barkley to make it clear to the audience that they were along for the ride and learning about all this stuff.
And, right. Yeah.
You know, it wasn't, they weren't trying to, they, CBS was not trying to hide the fact that Kenny Smith and Charles Barkley were NBA guys.
I understand that, but I got the sense all tournament that it was, that he, Gumbel was asking Greg Anthony and to some extent Seth Davis, because he wasn't on that set for the first 2 weeks, can you please solve this calculus equation, and then we look over at Kenny and say, you know, what's 2x minus 2, a simple algebraic equation, and then look at Charles and say, hey, Charles, what's 2 plus 3? I mean, that's what it felt like all the time, that Greg Anthony and Seth Davis were doing college basketball calculus Kenny Smith was doing a little bit higher than Barkley, and Barkley was doing simple addition. And again, it worked later on because then Barkley was able to focus on fewer teams, pull from his experience in this tournament and not just on a stat sheet. And it worked towards the end. And I did appreciate his energy. And he was actually the nicest to the players in the championship game. I mean, Greg Anthony was just, I think, preemptively. He looked over at the NBA guys and said, guys, this isn't representative of our sport, so please don't crush us. And he ended up crushing the teams more than the NBA guys who backed off a little bit. So I thought that was a decent balance. But at the same time, again, as much as I like the fact that they're there, I hope they're much better next year because I don't know if it was necessary. One thing I will say, the addition of Steve Kerr saved the booth.
He's very good.
I thought he saved the booth. I thought everyone's tired of Kellogg calling the ball the pumpkin and making some ridiculous analogy of like a mortgage or home equity. I don't even know what he was saying. And Nance is Nance. But I thought Steve Kerr thrust into the middle of that booth really worked. And I think obviously it benefited from the fact
that
he
did his homework too.
Well, but I think it helped that they had done games before the Big Ten tournament and other things before, or some regular season games, I think, in the Big Ten. It helped that they had some chemistry, but it felt rather seamless, and I think Kerr did a very good job.
I think he did a great job. And I think that, as I said the last time I was on the show, it's going to get better over time because now the executives at CBS and Turner and the talent will be able to look at what they did and go back and learn from it and make their changes for next year. And with all due respect to the people at ESPN, a lot of whom I like a lot, we were reminded once again how good a job CBS does with this thing. And I don't think ESPN would do it the same way. It would not be so much about the tournament, about the basketball, as it would be, I think, about other things.
Yeah, I always wonder who ESPN would put in that booth. Who would be their title game?
Probably Dan Shulman and Dick Vitale at this point, but 5 years ago it would have been Mike Patrick.
Yeah, oh, and I wonder if it would even be Vitale. Like, I wonder if they would think that he would be better served to be on the set and give it to Billis.
Oh, I think it...
Or give it to both of them.
I think it has to be.
It would be fascinating. We're never going to know, but it would be fascinating. All right, thank you for your time, sir.
Let me throw in one other thing.
Go ahead.
Since I've been, of course, a devoted listener to the show for a long time, and
I
see the clock is running out. I don't know if this is going to be my last appearance on the show, so I just wanted to say thank you for all the opportunities you've given me to be on here and to get my name out there a little bit, because I think you've done a really good job creating a forum for people like me who are in the mainstream media but who aren't quite so big a deal, you know, to get their name out there, just as much as us in the mainstream media have learned how to help get bloggers' names out there over the last couple of years. So thanks a lot.
Oh, yeah. Hey, come on. You're up early. I mean, you benefited from not sleeping. So I appreciate the fact that you're willing to talk.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks, man.